borrowed on my ring down into my pants pocket, and walked down Michigan Boulevard in Chicago, feeling as rich as Rockefeller. Every article of clothing I wore, from my underwear out, was the very best. That it was not paid for was nobody's business except mine and my tailors and my haberdashers. Every morning I dressed myself in an entirely new outfit and walked down the same street at precisely the same hour. That hour happened to be the time when a certain wealthy publisher usually walked down the same street on his way to lunch. I made it my business to speak to him each day, and occasionally I would stop for a minute to chat with him. After this daily meeting had been going on for about a week, I met this publisher one day, but decided I would see if he would let me get by without speaking. Watching him from under my eyelashes, I looked straight ahead and started to pass him when he stopped and motioned me over to the edge of the sidewalk, placed his hand on my shoulder, looked me over from head to foot, and said, "You look damn prosperous for a man who has just laid aside a uniform. Who makes your clothes?" "Well," I said, "Wilkie and Celery made this particular suit." He then wanted to know what sort of business I was engaged in. That airy atmosphere of prosperity, which I had been wearing, along with a new and different suit every day, had got the better of his curiosity, and I had hoped that it would. Flipping the ashes from my Havana Perfecto, I said, "Oh, I'm preparing the copy for a new magazine that I'm going to publish." "A new magazine, huh?" he queried. "And what are you going to call it?" "It is to be named Hill's Golden Rule." "Don't forget," said my publisher friend, "that I am in the business of printing and distributing magazines. Perhaps I can serve you also." That was the moment for which I had been waiting. I had that very moment and almost the very spot of ground on which we stood in mind when I was purchasing those new suits. But is it necessary to remind you that conversation never would have taken place had this publisher observed me walking down the street from day to day with a whipped dog look on my face, an unpressed suit on my back, and a look of poverty in my eye? An appearance of prosperity attracts attention always, with no exception whatsoever. Moreover, a look of prosperity attracts favorable attention, because the one dominating desire in every human heart is to be prosperous. My publisher friend invited me to his club for lunch. Before the coffee and cigars had been served, he had talked me out of the contract for printing and distributing my magazine. I had even consented to permit him to supply the capital without any interest charge. For the benefit of those who are not familiar with the publishing business, may I not offer the information that considerable capital is required for launching a new nationally distributed magazine? Capital in such large amounts is often hard to get, even with the best of security. The capital necessary for launching Hill's Golden Rule magazine, which you may have read, was well above $30,000, and every cent of it was raised on the front, created mostly by good clothes. True, there may have been some ability back of those clothes, but many millions of men have ability who never have anything else, and who are never heard of outside of the limited community in which they live. This is a rather sad truth. To some it may seem an unpardonable extravagance for one who was broke to have gone in debt for $675 worth of clothes, but the psychology back of that investment more than justified it. The appearance of prosperity not only made a favorable impression on those to whom I had to look for favors, but of more importance still was the effect that proper attire had on me. I not only knew that correct clothes would impress others favorably, but I knew also that good clothes would give me an atmosphere of self-reliance, without which I could not hope to regain my lost fortune. I got my first training in the psychology of good clothes from my friend Edwin C. Barnes, who was a close business associate of Thomas Edison. Barnes afforded considerable amusement for the Edison staff when some 20-odd years ago he rode into West Orange on a freight train, not being able to raise sufficient money for passenger fare, and announced at the Edison office that he had come to enter into a partnership with Mr. Edison. Nearly everybody around the Edison plant laughed at Barnes, except Edison himself. He saw something in the square jaw and determined face of the young Barnes, which most of the others did not see. despite the fact that the young man looked more like a tramp than he did a future partner of the greatest inventor on Earth. Barnes got his start, sweeping floors in the Edison office. That was all he sought, just a chance to get a toehold into the Edison organization. From there on, he made history that is well worth emulation by other young men who wish to make places for themselves. Barnes has now retired from active business, even though he is still a comparatively young man, and spends most of his time at his two beautiful homes in Bradentown, Florida, and Maine. He is a multimillionaire, prosperous and happy. I first became acquainted with Barnes during the early days of his association with Edison, before he had arrived. In those days, he had the largest and most expensive collection of clothing I had ever seen or heard of one man's owning. His wardrobe consisted of 31 suits, one for each day of the month. He never wore the same suit 2 days in succession. Moreover, all his suits were of the most expensive type. Incidentally, his clothes were made by the same tailors who made those 3 suits for me. He wore socks which cost $6 a pair. His shirts and other wearing apparel cost in similar proportion. His cravats were specially made at a cost of from $5 to $7.50 each. One day, in a spirit of fun, I asked him to save some of his old suits which he did not need for me. He informed me that he hadn't a single suit which he did not need. He then gave me a lesson on the psychology of clothes, which is well worth remembering. "I do not wear 31 suits of clothes," said he, "entirely for the impression they make on other people. I do it mostly for the impression they have on me." Barnes then told me of the day when he presented himself at the Edison office for a position. He said he had to walk around the plant 12 times before he worked up enough courage to announce himself, because he knew that he looked more like a tramp than he did a desirable employee. Barnes is said to be the most able salesman ever connected with the great inventor of West Orange. His entire fortune was made through his ability as a salesman, but he has often said that he never could have accomplished the result which have made him both wealthy and famous had it not been for his understanding of the psychology of clothes. I have met many salesmen in my time. During the past 10 years, I have personally trained and directed the efforts of more than 3,000 salespeople, both men and women, and I have observed that, without a single exception, the star producers were all people who understood and made good use of the psychology of clothes. I have seen a few well-dressed salespeople who made no outstanding records as salesmen, but I have yet to see the first poorly dressed man who became a star producer in the field of selling. I have studied the psychology of clothes for so long, and I have watched its effect on people in so many different walks of life, that I am fully convinced there is a close connection between clothes and success. Personally, I feel no need of 31 suits of clothes, but if my personality demanded a wardrobe of this size, I would manage to get it, no matter how much it might cost. To be well-dressed, a man should have at least 10 suits of clothes. He should have a different suit for each of the 7 days of the week, a full dress suit and a tuxedo for formal occasions, and a cutaway for formal afternoon occasions. For summer wear, he should have an assortment of at least 4 appropriate light suits, with blue coat and white flannel trousers for informal afternoon and evening occasions. If he plays golf, he should have at least 1 golf suit. This, of course, is for the man who is a notch or two above the mediocre class. The man who is satisfied with mediocrity needs but few clothes. It may be true, as the well-known poet has said, that clothes do not make the man. But no one can deny the fact that good clothes go a very long way toward giving him a favorable start. A man's bank will generally loan him all the money he wants when he does not need it, when he is prosperous, but never go to your bank for a loan with a shabby-looking suit on your back and a look of poverty in your eyes, for if you do, you will get the gate. Success attracts success. There is no escape from this great universal law. Therefore, if you wish to attract success, make sure that you look the part of success, whether your calling is that of day laborer or merchant prince. For the benefit of the more dignified students of this philosophy, who may object to the resorting to stunt stimuli or trick clothing as a means of achieving success, it may be profitably explained that practically every successful man on earth has discovered some form of stimulus through which he can and does drive himself onto greater effort. It may be shocking to members of the Anti-Saloon Society, but it is said to be true nevertheless that James Whitcomb Riley wrote his best poems when he was under the influence of alcohol. His stimulus was liquor. The author wishes it distinctly understood that he does not recommend the use of alcoholic or narcotic stimuli for any purpose whatsoever, as either will eventually destroy both body and mind of all who use them. Under the influence of alcohol, Riley became imaginative, enthusiastic, and an entirely different person, according to close personal friends of his. Edwin Barnes spurred himself into the necessary action to produce outstanding results with the aid of good clothes. Some men rise to great heights of achievement as the result of love for some women. Connect this with the brief suggestion to the subject which was made in the introductory lesson, and you will, if you are a person who knows the ways of men, be able to finish the discussion of this particular phase of enthusiasm stimulus without further comment by the author, which will not be appropriate for the younger minds that will assimilate this philosophy. Underworld characters who are engaged in the dangerous business of highway robbery, burglary, etc., generally dope themselves for the occasion of their operation with cocaine, morphine, and other narcotics. Even in this, there is a lesson which shows that practically all men need temporary or artificial stimuli to drive them to greater effort than the normally employed in an ordinary pursuit of life. Successful people have discovered ways and means which they believe best suited to their own needs to produce stimuli which cause them to rise to heights of endeavor above the ordinary. One of the most successful writers in the world employs an orchestra of beautifully dressed young women who play for him while he writes. Seated in a room that has been artistically decorated to suit his own taste, under lights that have been colored, tinted, and softened, these beautiful young ladies, dressed in handsome evening gowns, play his favorite music. To use his own words, "I become drunk with enthusiasm under the influence of this environment and rise to heights I never know or feel on other occasion. It is then that I do my work. The thoughts pour in on me as if they were dictated by an unseen and unknown power." This author gets much of his inspiration from music and art. Once a week, he spends at least an hour in an art museum, looking at the works of the masters. On these occasions, again using his own words, "I get enough enthusiasm from 1 hour's visit in the Museum of Art to carry me for 2 days." Edgar Allan Poe wrote The Raven when it is reported he was more than half intoxicated. Oscar Wilde wrote his poems under the influence of a form of stimulus which cannot be appropriately mentioned in the course of this nature. Henry Ford, so it is believed by this author, who admits that this is merely the author's opinion, got his real start as the result of his love for his charming life companion. It was she who inspired him, gave him faith in himself, and kept him keyed up so that he carried on in the face of adversities which would have killed off a dozen ordinary men. These incidences are cited as evidence that men of outstanding achievement have, by accident or design, discovered ways and means of stimulating themselves to a higher state of enthusiasm. Associate that which has been here stated with what was said concerning the law of the master mind in the introductory lesson, and you will have an entirely new conception of the modus operandi through which that law may be applied. You will also have a somewhat different understanding of the real purpose of allied effort in the spirit of perfect harmony, which constitutes the best-known method of bringing into use the law of the master mind. At this point, it seems appropriate to call your attention to the manner in which the lesson of this course blend. You will observe that each lesson covers the subject intended to be covered. In addition to this, it overlaps and gives the student a better understanding of some other lesson or lessons of the course. In the light of that which has been said in this lesson, For example, the student will better understand the real purpose of the law of the mastermind, that purpose being, in the main, a practical method of stimulating the mind of all who participate in the group constituting the mastermind. Times too numerous to be here described, this author has gone into conference with men whose faces showed the signs of care, who had the appearance of worry written all over them, only to see these same men straighten up their shoulders, tilt their chins at a higher angle, soften their faces with smiles of confidence, and get down to business with that sort of enthusiasm which knows no defeat. The change took place the moment harmony of purpose was established. If a man goes about the affairs of life in the same day-in and day-out prosaic, lackadaisical spirit, devoid of enthusiasm, he is doomed to failure. Nothing can save him until he changes his attitude and learns how to stimulate his mind and body to the unusual heights of enthusiasm at will. The author is unwilling to leave this subject without having stated the principle here described in so many different ways that is bound to be understood and also respected by the students of this course, who all will remember are men and women of all sorts of nature, experience, and degrees of intelligence. For this reason, much repetition is essential. Your business in life, you are reminded once again, is to achieve success. With the stimulus you will experience from studying this philosophy, and with the aid of the ideas you will gather from it, plus the personal cooperation of the author who will give you an accurate inventory of your outstanding qualities, you should be able to create a definite plan that will lift you to great heights of achievement. However, there is no plan that can produce this desirable of results without the aid of some influence that will cause you to arouse yourself in the spirit of enthusiasm to where you will exert greater than the ordinary effort which you put into your daily occupation. You are now ready for the lesson on self-control. As you read that lesson, you will observe that it has a vital bearing on this lesson, just as this lesson has a direct connection with the preceding lesson on a definite chief aim, self-confidence, initiative in leadership, and imagination. The next lesson describes a law which serves as the balance wheel of this entire philosophy. The Seven Deadly Horsemen, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. The seven horsemen are labeled in order shown: intolerance, greed, revenge, egotism, suspicion, jealousy, and the worst enemy that any man has is the one that walks around under his own hat. If you could see yourself as others see you, the enemies that you harbor in your own personality might be discovered and thrown out. The seven enemies named in this essay are the commonest which ride millions of men and women to failure without being discovered. Weigh yourself carefully and find out how many of the seven you are harboring. You see in this picture seven deadly warriors. From birth until death, every human being must give battle to these enemies. Your success will be measured very largely by the way you manage your battle against these swift riders. As you look at this picture, you will say, of course, that it is only imagination. True, the picture is imagery, but the swift riders of destruction are real. If these enemies rode openly on real horses, they would not be dangerous, because they could be rounded up and put out of commission. But they ride unseen in the minds of men. So silently and subtly do they work that most people never recognize their presence. Take inventory of yourself and find out how many of these seven horsemen you are harboring. In the foreground, you will find the most dangerous and the commonest of the riders. You will be fortunate if you discover this enemy and protect yourself against it. This cruel warrior, intolerance, has killed more people, destroyed more friendships, brought more misery and suffering into the world, and caused more wars than all of the other six horsemen that you see in this picture. Until you master intolerance, you will never become an accurate thinker. This enemy of mankind closes up the mind and pushes reason and logic and facts into the background. If you find yourself hating those whose religious viewpoint is different from your own mind, you may be sure that the most dangerous of the seven deadly horsemen still rides in your brain. Next, in the picture, you will observe revenge and greed. These riders travel side by side. Where one is found, the other is always close at hand. Greed warps and twists man's brain so that he wants to build a fence around the earth and keep everyone else on the outside of it. This is the enemy that drives man to accumulate millions upon millions of dollars, which he does not need and can never use. This is the enemy that causes man to twist the screw until he has wrung the last drop of blood from his fellow man. And thanks to revenge, which rides alongside of greed, the unfortunate person who gives brain room to these cruel twins is not satisfied to merely take away his fellow man's earthly belongings. He wants to destroy his reputation in a bargain. Verse. Revenge is a naked sword. It has neither hilt nor guard. Wouldst thou wield this brand of the Lord? Is thy grasp then firm and hard? But the closer thy clutch of the blade, the deadlier blow thou wouldst deal. Deeper wound in thy hand is made, it is thy blood reddens the steel. And when thou hast dealt the blow, when the blade from thy hand has flown, instead of the heart of the foe, thou mayst find it sheathed in thy own. End of verse. If you would know how deadly are envy and greed, study the history of every man who has set out to become the ruler of this world. If you do not wish to undertake so ambitious a program of research, then study the people around you, those who have tried and those who are now trying to feather their own nests at the cost of others. Greed and revenge stand at the crossroads of life, where they turn aside to failure and misery every person who would take the road that leads to success. It is a part of your business not to permit them to interfere with you when you approach one of those crossroads. Both individuals and nations ride rapidly decline where greed and envy ride in the minds of those who dominate. Take a look at Mexico and Spain if you wish to know what happens to the envious and the greedy. Most important of all, take a look at yourself and make sure these two deadly enemies are not riding in your brain. Turn your attention now to two more twins of destruction, egotism and suspicion. Observe that they also ride side by side. There is no hope of success for the person who suffers either from too much self-love or lack of confidence in others. Someone who likes to manipulate figures has estimated that the largest club in the world is the It Can't Be Done Club. It is claimed that there are approximately 99 million members of this club in the United States of America alone. If you have no faith in other people, you have not the seed of success in you. Suspicion is a prolific germ. If permitted to get a start, it rapidly multiplies itself until it leaves no room for faith. Without faith, no man may enjoy enduring success. Running like a golden cord of illumination throughout the Bible is the admonition to have faith. Before civilization lost itself in its mad rush for dollars, men understood the power of faith. For verily I say unto you, if ye have faith as a grain of mustard seed, ye shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. The writer of this passage, which appears in the Bible, understands a great law which but few of today understand. Believe in people if you would have them believe in you. Kill off suspicion. If you do not, it will kill you off. If you would have power, cultivate faith in mankind. Egotism thrives where suspicion exists. Interest yourself in others, and you will be too busy to indulge in self-love. Observe those around you who begin every sentence with the personal pronoun, I, and you will notice that they are suspicious of other people. The man who can forget himself while engaging in useful service to other people is never cursed with suspicion. Study those about you who are both suspicious and egotistical, and see how many of this type you can name who are successful in whatever work they may be engaged in. And while making this study of others, study also yourself. Be sure that you are not bound down by egotism and suspicion. Bringing up the rear of this deadly group of riders, you see two horsemen. One is Jealousy, and the name of the other has been purposely omitted. Each reader of this article may take inventory of himself and give the seventh rider a name that fits whatever he finds in his own mind. Some will name this rider Dishonesty. Others will name it Procrastination. A few will have the courage to name it Uncontrolled Sex Desire. As for you, name it whatever you please, but be sure to give it a name. Perhaps your own imagination will supply an appropriate name as a fellow traveler for Jealousy. You will be better prepared to give the unnamed rider a name if you know that Jealousy is a form of insanity. Facts are sometimes cruel things to face. It is a fact that Jealousy is a form of insanity, known to the medical fraternity as dementia precoce. O Jealousy, the ugliest fiend of hell, thy deadly venom preys on my vitals, turns the healthful hue of my fresh cheek to haggard shallowness, and drinks my spirit up. You will notice that Jealousy rides just back of Suspicion. Some who read this will say that Jealousy and Suspicion should have ridden side by side, as one often leads to the other in man's mind. Jealousy is the most common form of insanity. It rides in the minds of both men and women, sometimes with a real cause, but more often without any cause whatsoever. This deadly rider is a great friend of the divorce lawyers. It also keeps detective agencies busy night and day. It takes its regular toll of murder. It breaks up homes and makes widows of mothers and orphans of innocent little children. Peace and happiness can never be yours as long as the rider remains unharnessed in your brain. Man and wife may go through life together in poverty and still be very happy, if both are free from this child of insanity known as Jealousy. Examine yourself carefully, and if you find any evidence of jealousy in your mind, begin at once to master it. Jealousy rides in many forms. When it first begins to creep into the brain, it manifests itself in something after this fashion. I wonder where she is and what she is doing while I'm away. Or, I wonder if he does not see another woman when he is away from me. When these questions begin to arise in your mind, do not call in a detective. Instead, go to the psychopathic hospital and have yourself examined, because more than likely you are suffering from a mild form of insanity. Get your foot on Jealousy's neck before it gets its clutches on your throat. After you have read this essay, lay it aside and think about it. At first you may say, "This does not apply to me. I have no imaginary horseman in my brain." And you could be right. One out of every 10 million could say this and be right. The other 9,999,999 would be wrong. Do not fool yourself. You may be in that larger class. The purpose of this article is to get you to see yourself as you are. If you are suffering failure and poverty and misery, in any of these forms, you are sure to discover one or more of these deadly riders in your brain. Make no mistake about it. Those who have all they want, including happiness and good health, have driven the seven horsemen out of their brains. Come back to this essay a month from now, after you have had time to analyze yourself carefully. Read it again, and it may bring you face to face with facts that you will emancipate you from a horde of cruel enemies that now ride within your brain without you knowing it. End of Lesson 7. The Law of Success, Lesson 8, Self-Control. You can do it if you believe you can. In the preceding lesson, you learned of the value of enthusiasm. You also learned how to generate enthusiasm and how to transmit its influence to others through the principle of suggestion. You come now to the study of self-control, through which you may direct your enthusiasm to constructive ends. Without self-control, enthusiasm resembles the unharnessed lightning of an electrical storm. It may strike anywhere. It may destroy life and property. Enthusiasm is the vital quality that arouses you to action, while self-control is the balance wheel that directs your action so that it will build up and not tear down. To be a person who is well-balanced, You must be a person in whom enthusiasm and self-control are equalized. A survey which I had just completed of the 160,000 adult inmates of the penitentiaries of the United States discloses the startling fact that 92% of these unfortunate men and women are in prison because they lacked the necessary self-control to direct their energies constructively. Read the foregoing paragraph again. It is authentic. It is startling. It is the fact that the majority of a man's grief come about through the lack of self-control. The Holy Scriptures are full of admonition in support of self-control. They even urge us to love our enemies and to forgive those who injure us. The law of non-resistance runs like a golden cord throughout the Bible. Study the records of those whom the world calls great and observe that every one of them possess this quality of self-control. For example, study the characteristics of our own immortal Lincoln. In the midst of his most trying hours, he exercised patience, poise, and self-control. There were some of the qualities which made him the great man that he was. He found disloyalty in some of the members of his cabinet, but for the reason that this disloyalty was toward him personally, and because those in whom he found it had qualities which made them valuable to this country, Lincoln exercised self-control and disregarded the objectionable qualities. How many men do you know who have self-control to equal this? In language more forceful than it was polished, Billy Sunday exclaimed from the pulpit, "There is something as rotten as hell about the man who is always trying to show some other fellow up." I wonder if the devil didn't tell, "Amen, brother," when Billy made that statement. However, self-control becomes an important factor in this reading course on the law of success, not so much because lack of it works hardships and those who become its victims, as for the reason that those who do not exercise it suffer the loss of a great power which they need in their struggle for the achievement of their definite chief aim. If you neglect to exercise self-control, you are not only likely to injure others, but you are sure to injure yourself. During the early part of my public career, I discovered what havoc lack of self-control was playing in my life, and this discovery came about through a very commonplace incident. I believe it not out of place here to digress by making the statement that most of the great truths of life are wrapped up in the ordinary, commonplace events of everyday life. This discovery taught me one of the most important lessons I've ever learned. It came about in this way. One day in the building in which I had my office, the janitor and I had a misunderstanding. This led to a most violent form of mutual dislike between us. As a means of showing his contempt for me, this janitor would switch off the electric lights of the building when he knew that I was there alone at work in my study. This happened on several occasions until I finally decided to strike back. My opportunity came one Sunday when I came to my study to prepare an address that I had to deliver the following night. I had hardly seated myself at my desk when off went the lights. I jumped to my feet and ran toward the basement of the building where I knew I would find the janitor. When I arrived, I found him busily engaged, shoveling coal into the furnace and whistling as though nothing unusual had happened. Without ceremony, I pitched into him, and for 5 minutes I hurled adjectives at him, which were hotter than the fire that he was feeding. Finally, I ran out of words and had to slow down. Then he straightened himself up, looked back over his shoulder, and in a calm, smooth tone of voice that was full of poise and self-control, and with a smile on his face that reached from ear to ear, he said, "Why, you all's just a little bit excited about this morning, aren't you?" That remark cut as though it had been a stiletto. I imagine my feelings as I stood there before an illiterate man who could neither read nor write, but who, despite this handicap, had defeated me in a duel that had been fought on grounds and with a weapon of my own choice. My conscience pointed an accusing finger at me. I knew that not only had I been defeated, but that was worse. I knew that I was the aggressor and that I was in the wrong, which only served to intensify my humiliation. Not only did my conscience point an accusing finger at me, but it placed some very embarrassing thoughts in my mind. It mocked me and it tantalized me. There I stood, a boasted student of advanced psychology, an exponent of the Golden Rule philosophy, having at least a fair acquaintance with the works of Shakespeare, Socrates, Plato, Emerson, and the Bible. While facing me stood a man who knew nothing of literature or of philosophy, but who had, despite this lack of knowledge, whipped me in a battle of words. I turned and went back to my office as rapidly as I could. There was nothing else for me to do. As I began to think the matter over, I saw my mistake, but true to nature, I was reluctant to do that which I knew must be done to right the wrong. I knew that I would have to apologize to that man before I could place myself at peace in my own heart, much less with him. Finally, I made up my mind to go back down to the basement and suffer this humility which I knew I had to undergo. The decision was not easily reached, nor did I reach it quickly. I started down, but I walked more slowly than I had when I went down on the first trip. I was trying to think how I would make the second approach so as to suffer the least humiliation possible. When I got to the basement, I called to the janitor to come over to the door. In a calm, kindly tone of voice, he asked, "What do you wish this time?" I informed him that I had come back to apologize for the wrong I had done, and if he would permit me to do so. Again the smile spread all over his face as he said, "For the love of the Lord, you don't have to apologize. Nobody heard you except these four walls and you and me. I ain't gonna tell it, and I know you ain't gonna tell it, so just forget it." And that remark hurt more than his first one, for he had not only expressed a willingness to forgive me, but he had actually indicated his willingness to help me cover the incident up, so it would not become known and do me any injury. But I walked over to him and took him by the hand. I shook with more than one hand, I shook with my heart, and as I walked back to my office I felt good for having summoned the courage with which to right the wrong I had done. This is not the end of the story, it is only the beginning. Following this incident, I made a resolution that I would never again place myself in a position in which another man, whether he be an illiterate janitor or a man of letters, could humiliate me because I had lost my self-control. Following that resolution, a remarkable change began to take place in me. My pen began to take on a greater power. My spoken words began to carry greater weight. I began to make more friends and fewer enemies among men of my acquaintance. The incident marked one of the most important turning points of my life. It taught me that no man can control others until he first controls himself. It gave me a clear conception of the philosophy back of these words, "Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad." It also gave me a clear conception of the law of non-resistance, and helped me interpret many passages of the Holy Scripture bearing on the subject of this law, as I had never before interpreted them. This incident placed in my hands the passkey to a storehouse of knowledge that is illuminating and helpful in all that I do, and later in life, when enemies sought to destroy me. It gave me a powerful weapon of defense that has never failed me. Lack of self-control is the average salesman's most damaging weakness. The prospective buyer says something that the salesman does not wish to hear, and if he has not this quality of self-control, he will strike back with a counter-remark that is fatal to his sale. In one of the large department stores of Chicago, I witnessed an incident that illustrated the importance of self-control. A long line of women were in front of the complaint desk, telling their troubles and the store's fault to the young woman in charge. Some of the women were angry and unreasonable, and some of them made very ugly remarks. The young woman at the desk received the disgruntled women without the slightest sign of resentment at the remarks. With a smile on her face, she directed these women to the proper departments with such charming grace and poise that I marveled at her self-control. Standing just back of her was another young woman who was making notations on slips of paper and passing them in front of her. As the woman in line unburdened their trouble, these slips of paper contained the gist of what the women in line were saying, minus the vitriolic coloring and the anger. The smiling young woman at the desk, who was hearing the complaint, was stone deaf. Her assistant supplied her with all the necessary facts, though those slips of paper. I was so impressed with the plan that I sought the manager of the store and interviewed him. He informed me that he had selected a deaf woman for one of the most trying and important positions in the store for the reason that he had not been able to find any person with sufficient self-control to fill the place. As I stood and watched the line of angry women, I observed what pleasant effect the smile of the young woman at the desk had upon them. They came before her growling like wolves and went away as meek and quiet as sheep. In fact, some of them had sheepish looks on their faces as they left, because the young woman's self-control had made them ashamed of themselves. Ever since I witnessed that scene, I have thought of the poise and self-control of that young woman at the desk every time I felt myself becoming irritated at remarks which I did not like, and often I have thought that everybody should have a set of mental earmuffs which they could slip over their ears at times. Personally, I have developed the habit of closing my ears against much of the idle chatter, such as I use to make it business to resent. Life is too short, and there is too much constructive work to be done to justify us in striking back at everyone who says that which we do not wish to hear. In the practice of law, I have observed a very clever trick that trial lawyers use when they wish to get a statement of facts from a belligerent witness who answers question with the proverbial, "I do not remember" or "I do not know." When everything else fails, they manage to make such a witness angry, and in this state of mind they cause him to lose his self-control and make statements that he would not have made had he kept a cool head. Most of us go through life with our weather eye cast skyward in quest of trouble. We usually find that for which we are looking for. In my travels, I have been a student of men whom I have heard in Pullman car conversation, and I have observed the practicality 9 out of every 10 have so little self-control that they will invite themselves into the discussion of almost any subject that may be brought up. But few men are content to sit in a smoking compartment and listen to a conversation without joining in and airing their views. Once I was traveling from Albany to New York City. On the way down, the smoking car club started a conversation about the late Richard Croker, who was then chief of Tammany Hall. The discussion became loud and bitter. Everyone became angry except one old gentleman who was agitating the argument and taking a lively interest in it. He remained calm and seemed to enjoy all the mean things the others said about that tiger of Tammany Hall. Of course, I supposed that he was an enemy of the Tammany chief, but he wasn't. He was Richard Croker himself. This was one of his clever tricks through which he found out what people thought of him and what his enemies' plans were. Whatever else Richard Croker might have been, he was a man of self-control. Perhaps that is one reason why he remained undisputed boss of Tammany Hall as long as he did. Men who control themselves usually boss the job, no matter what it may be. Please read again the last sentence of the preceding paragraph, for it carries a subtle suggestion that might be of profit to you. This is a commonplace incident, but it is in just such incidences that great truths of life are hidden because the settings are ordinary and commonplace. Not long ago, I accompanied my wife on a bargain hunting bee. Our attention was attracted by a crowd of women who were elbowing each other out of the way in front of a petticoat counter at which bargains were being offered. One lady, who looked to be around 45 years of age, crawled on her hands and knees through the crowd and bobbed up in the front of a customer who had engaged in the attention of the saleswoman ahead of her. In a loud, high-pitched tone of voice, she demanded attention. The saleswoman was a diplomat who understood human nature. She also possessed self-control, for she smiled sweetly at the intruder and said, "Yes, miss, I will be with you in a moment." The intruder calmed herself. I do not know whether it was the "yes, miss," or the sweet tone in which it was said that modified her attitude, but it was one or the other. Perhaps it was both. I do know, however, that the saleswoman was rewarded for her self-control by the sale of 3 petticoats, and the happy miss went away feeling much younger for the remark. Roast turkey is a very popular dish, but overeating of it cost a friend of mine, who is in the printing business, a $50,000 order. It happened the day after Thanksgiving, when I called at his office for the purpose of introducing him to a prominent Russian who had come to the United States to publish a book. The Russian spoke broken English, and it was therefore hard for him to make himself easily understood. During the interview, he asked my printer friend a question which was mistaken as a reflection upon his ability as a printer. In an unguarded moment, he countered with this remark, "The trouble with you Bolsheviks is that you look with suspicion on the remainder of the world just because of your own short-sightedness." My Bolshevik friend nudged me on the elbow and whispered, "The gentleman seems to be sick. We shall call again when he is feeling better." But he never called again. He placed his order with another printer, and I learned afterward that the profit on that order was more than $10,000. $10,000 seems a high price to pay for a plate of turkey, but that is the price that it cost my printer friend, for he offered me an apology for his conduct on the ground that his turkey dinner had given him indigestion, and therefore he had lost his self-control. One of the largest chain store concerns in the world has adopted a unique, though effective, method of employing salespeople who have developed the essential quality of self-control, which are all successful salespeople must possess. This concern has it in its employ a very clever woman who visits department stores and other places where salespeople are employed and selects certain one whom she believes to possess tact and self-control. But to be sure of her judgment, she approaches these salespeople and has them show her their wares. She asks all sorts of questions that are designed to try their patience. If they stand the test, they are offered better positions. If they fail in the test, they have merely allowed a good opportunity to pass by without knowing it. No doubt all people who refuse or neglect to exercise self-control are literally turning opportunity after opportunity away without knowing it. One day I was standing at the glove counter of a large retail store talking to a young man who was employed there. He was telling me he had been with the store 4 years, but on account of the short-sightedness of the store, his services had not been appreciated, and he was looking for another position. In the midst of this conversation, a customer walked up to him and asked to see some hats. He paid no attention to the customer's inquiry until he had finished telling me his troubles, despite the fact that the customer was obviously becoming impatient. Finally, he returned to the customer and said, "This isn't the hat department." When the customer inquired as to where he might find that department, the young man replied, "Ask the floor walker over there. He will direct you." For 4 years, this young man had been standing on top of a fine opportunity, but he did not know it. He could have made a friend of every person whom he served in that store, and these friends could have made him one of the most valuable men in the store, because they would have come back to trade with him. Snappy answers to inquiring customers do not bring them back. One rainy afternoon, an old lady walked into a Pittsburgh department store and wandered around in an aimless sort of way, very much in the manner that people who have no intention of buying often do. Most of the salespeople gave her the once-over and busied themselves by straightening the stock on their shelves so as to avoid being troubled by her. One of the young men saw her and made it his business to inquire politely if he may serve her. She informed him that she was only waiting for it to stop raining, that she did not wish to make any purchase. The young man assured her that she was welcome, and by engaging her in conversation made her feel that she had meant what she said. When she was ready to go, he accompanied her to the street and raised her umbrella for her. She asked for his card and went on her way. The incident had been forgotten by the young man when one day he was called into the office by the head of the firm and shown a letter from a lady who wanted a salesman to go to Scotland and take an order for the furnishings for a mansion. That lady was Andrew Carnegie's mother. She was also the same woman who the young man had so courteously escorted to the street many months ago. In the letter, Mrs. Carnegie specified that this young man was the only one whom she desired to be sent to take her order. That order amounted to an enormous sum, and the incident brought the young man an opportunity for advancement that he might never have had except for his courtesy to an old lady who did not look like a ready sale. Just as the great fundamental laws of life are wrapped up in the commonest sort of everyday experience that most of us never notice, so are the real opportunities often hidden in the seemingly unimportant transactions of life. Ask the next 10 people whom you meet why they have not accomplished more in their respective lines of endeavor, and at least 9 of them will tell you that opportunity does not seem to come around their way. Go a step further and analyze each of these 9 accurately by observing their actions for one single day, and the chances are that you will find that every one of them is turning away the finest sort of opportunities every hour of the day. One day I went to visit a friend who was associated with a commercial school in the capacity of solicitor. When I asked him how he was getting along, he replied, "Rotten. I see a large number of people, but I am not making enough sales to give me a good living. In fact, my account with the school is overdrawn, and I am thinking about changing positions as there is no opportunity here." It happened that I was on my vacation and had 10 days' time that I could use as I wished, so I challenged his remark that he had no opportunity by telling him that I could turn his position into $250 in a week's time and show him how to make it worth that every week thereafter. He looked at me in amazement and asked me not to joke with him over so serious a matter. When he was finally convinced that I was in earnest, he ventured to inquire how I would perform this miracle. Then I asked him if he ever heard of organized effort, to which he replied, "What do you mean by organized effort?" I informed him that I had referenced the direction of his efforts in such a manner that he would enroll from 5 to 10 students with the same amount of effort that he had been putting into the enrollment of one or more. He said he was willing to be shown, so I gave him instructions to arrange for me to speak before the employees of one of the local department stores. He made the appointment and I delivered the address. In my talk, I outlined a plan through which the employees could not only increase their ability so that they could earn more money in their present position, but it also offered them an opportunity to prepare themselves for greater responsibilities and better positions. Following my talk, which of course was designed for that purpose, my friend enrolled 8 of those employees for night courses in the commercial school which he represented. The following night, he booked me for a similar address before the employees of a laundry, and following the address, he enrolled 3 more students. 2 of them, young women who worked over the washing machines at the hardest sort of labor. 2 days later, he booked me for an address before the employees of one of the local banks, and following the address, he enrolled 4 more students, making a total of 15 students, and the entire time consumed was not more than 6 hours, including the time required for the delivery of the address and the enrollment of the students. My friend's commission on the transaction was a little over $400. These places of employment were within 15 minutes' walk of this man's place of business, but he had never thought of looking there for business. Neither had he ever thought of aligning himself with a speaker who could assist him in a group selling. That man now owns a splendid commercial school of his own, and I am informed that his net income last year was over $10,000. No opportunities come your way? Perhaps they come, but you do not see them. Perhaps you will see them in the future as you are preparing yourself through the aid of this reading course on the Law of Success, so that you can recognize an opportunity when you see it. The 6th lesson of this course is on the subject of imagination, which was the chief factor that entered into the transaction that I have just related. Imagination plus a definite plan plus self-confidence plus action were the main factors that entered into this transaction. You now know how to use all of these, and before you shall have finished this lesson, you will understand how to direct those factors through self-control. Now let us examine the scope of meaning of the term self-control, as it is used in connection with this course, by describing the general conduct of a person who possesses it. A person with well-developed self-control does not indulge in hatred, envy, jealousy, fear, revenge, or any similar destructive emotions. A person with well-developed self-control does not go into ecstasies or become ungovernably enthusiastic over anything or anybody. Greed and selfishness and self-approval beyond the point of accurate self-analysis and appreciation of one's actual merits indicate lack of self-control in one of its most dangerous forms. Self-confidence is one of the most important essentials of success, but when this faculty is developed beyond the point of reason, it becomes very dangerous. Self-sacrifice is a commendable quality, but when it is carried to extremes, it also becomes one of the dangerous forms of lack of self-control. You owe it to yourself not to permit your emotions to place your happiness in the keeping of another person. Love is essential for happiness, but the person who loves so deeply that his or her happiness is placed entirely in the hands of another resembles a little lamb who crept into the den of the nice, gentle little wolf and begged to be permitted to lie down and go to sleep, or the canary bird that persisted in playing with the cat's whiskers. A person with well-developed self-control will not permit himself to be influenced by the cynic or the pessimist, nor will he permit another person to do his thinking for him. A person with well-developed self-control will stimulate his imagination and his enthusiasm until they have produced action, but he will then control that action and not permit it to control him. A person with well-developed self-control will never, under any circumstances, slander another person or seek revenge for any cause whatsoever. A person with self-control will not hate those who do not agree with him. Instead, he will endeavor to understand the reason for their disagreement and profit by it. We come now to a form of lack of self-control which causes more grief than all other forms combined. It is the habit of forming opinions before they study the fact. We will not analyze this particular form in detail in this lesson, for the reason that it is fully covered in Lesson 11 on Accurate Thought, but the subject of self-control could not be covered without at least a passing reference to this common evil to which we are all more or less addicted. No one has any right to form an opinion that is not based either upon that which he believes to be facts or upon a reasonable hypothesis. Yet, if you will observe yourself carefully, you will catch yourself forming opinions on nothing more substantial than your desire for a thing to be or not to be. Another grievous form of lack of self-control is the spending habit. I have reference, of course, to the habit of spending beyond one's needs. This habit has become so prevalent since the close of the World War that is alarming. A well-known economist has prophesied that three more generations will transform the United States from the richest country in the world to the poorest if the children are not taught the savings habit as part of their training in both the schools and the homes. On every hand, we see people buying automobiles on the installment plan instead of buying homes. Within the last 15 years, the automobile fad has become so popular that literally tens of thousands of people are mortgaging their futures to own cars. A prominent scientist who has a keen sense of humor has prophesied that not only will this habit grow lean bank accounts, but if persisted in, it will eventually grow babies whose legs will have become transformed into wheels. This is a speed-mad, money-spending age in which we are living, and the uppermost thought in the minds of most of us is to live faster than our neighbors. Not long ago, the general manager of a concern that employs 600 men and women became alarmed over the large number of his employees who were becoming involved with loan sharks, and decided to put an end to this evil. When he completed his investigation, he found that not only 9% of his employees had savings account, and of the other 91% who had no money ahead, 75% were in debt in one form or another, some of them being hopelessly involved financially. Of those who were in debt, 210 owned automobiles. We are creatures of imitation. We find it hard to resist the temptation to do that which we see others doing. If our neighbors buy a Buick, we must imitate him, and if we cannot scrape together enough to make the first payment on a Buick, we must at least have a Ford. Meanwhile, we take no heed of the morrow. The old-fashioned rainy day nest egg has become obsolete. We live from day to day. We buy our coal by the pound and our flour in 5-pound sacks, thereby paying a third more for it than it ought to cost because it is distributed in smaller quantities. Of course, this warning does not apply to you. It is intended only for those who are binding themselves in the chains of poverty by spending beyond their earning capacity, and who have not yet heard that they are all definite laws which must be observed by all who would attain success. The automobile is one of the modern wonders of the world, but it is more often a luxury than it is a necessity, and tens of thousands of people who are now stepping on the gas at a lively pace are going to see some dangerous skidding when their rainy days arrive. It requires considerable self-control to use the streetcar as a means of transportation when people all around us are driving automobiles. But all who exercise this self-control are practically sure to see the day when many who are now driving cars will be either riding the streetcars or walking. It was this modern tendency to spend the entire income which prompted Henry Ford to safeguard his employees with certain restrictions when he established his famous $5 a day minimum wage scale. 20 years ago, if a boy wanted a wagon, he fashioned the wheels out of boards and had the pleasure of building it himself. Now if a boy wants a wagon, he cries out for it and gets it. Lack of self-control is being developed in the oncoming generation by their parents, who have become victims of the spending habit. 3 generations ago, practically any boy could mend his own shoes with a family cobbling outfit. Today, the boy takes his shoes to the corner shoe shop and pays $1.75 for heels and half soles, and this habit is by no means confined to the rich and well-to-do classes. I repeat, the spending habit is turning America into a nation of paupers. I am safe in assuming that you are struggling to attain success, for if you were not, you would not be reading this course. Let me remind you, then, that a little savings account will attract many an opportunity to you that would not come your way without it. The size of the account is not so important as is the fact that you have established the savings habit, for this habit marks you as a person who exercises an important form of self-control. The modern tendency of those who work for a salary is to spend it all. If a man who receives $3,000 a year and manages to get along on it fairly well receives an increase of $1,000 a year, does he continue to live on $3,000 and place the increased portion of his income into a savings account? No, not unless he is one of the few who has developed the savings habit. Then, what does he do with his additional $1,000? He trades in the old automobile and buys a more expensive one. And at the end of the year, he is poorer on a $4,000 income than he was the previous year on a $3,000 income. This is a modern 20th century model American that I am describing, and you will be lucky if, upon close analysis, you do not find yourself to be one of this class. Somewhere between the miser who hoards every penny he gets his hand on in an old sock and the man who spends every cent he can earn or borrow, there is a happy medium. And if you enjoy life with reasonable assurance of average freedom and contentment, you must find this halfway point and adopt it as part of your self-control program. Self-discipline is the most essential factor in the development of personal power, because it enables you to control your appetite and your tendency to spend more than you earn and your habit of striking back at those who offend you, and the other destructive habits which cause you to dissipate your energies through non-productive effort that takes on forms too numerous to be cataloged in this lesson. Very early in my public career, I was shocked when I learned how many people there are who devote most of their energies to tearing down that which the builders construct. By some queer turn of the wheel of fate, one of these destroyers crossed my path by making it his business to try to destroy my reputation. At first I was inclined to strike back at him, but as I sat at my typewriter late one night, a thought came to me which changed my entire attitude toward this man. Removing the sheet of paper that was in my typewriter, I inserted another one on which I stated this thought in these words: "You have a tremendous advantage over the man who does you an injury. You have it within your power to forgive him, while he has no such advantage over you." As I finished writing these lines, I made up my mind that I had come to the point at which I had to decide upon a policy that would serve as a guide concerning my attitude toward those who criticize my work or try to destroy my reputation. I reached this decision by reasoning something after this fashion. 2 courses of action were open to me. I could waste much of my time and energy in striking back at those who would try to destroy me, or I could devote this energy to furthering my life work and let the result of that work serve as my sole answer to all who would criticize my efforts or question my motives. I decided upon the latter as being the better policy and adopted it. By their deeds you shall know them. If your deeds are constructive, and you are at peace with yourself in your own heart, you will not find it necessary to stop and explain your motives, for they will explain themselves.